that's what really inspired me to get into film. But you can make such a difference in the world and really change lives in a way that you can't one by one.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, Conversations and Life Lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. It occurs to me that this process of being a human being is complicated. There'll definitely be changes and transitions along the way. Maybe those changes and transitions are physical, maybe they're mental, maybe they're emotional, maybe they're all three. Many of our guests come to the ranch on a yearly basis to help them figure out how to navigate the next transition or change in their life. They might find their answer walking on the mountain and seeing the first light of the day. Maybe it'll occur in a sound bath class, or maybe in a conversation with another guest going through something similar. My guest today, Lydia B. Smith, has been in the film and television industry for 30 years. She was busy making films and documentaries for other people. And then she was called to walk a 500-mile trail in Spain called the Camino de Santiago. This inspired her to do a documentary, her first solo documentary, on her experience and the experience of the other 500,000 people that walk that trail on a yearly basis. Her latest project, Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, has just been recently released. I'm excited to learn about her experiences and what inspired her. Hi, Lydia. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Barry. Good to be here.
And you're coming to me from Portland today, right?
Yep, Portland, Oregon.
And I noticed when I look you up, it's always Lydia B. Smith. Is that because that Smith last name is...
Yeah. Just to distinguish us from all the other million Lydia Smiths that are out there.
What does the B stand for?
Bonnell.
Oh.
It's a family name.
Yeah, that's what I was guessing that. So I have so many things I want to talk to you about, but I do want to mention that you're going to be presenting at the ranch in December this year, December 14th week. So our listeners will know that if they want to come listen to you in person, that'd be awesome. I want to talk to you about so many things, your spiritual journey, your documentary on the Camino, and your latest podcast series. So those are my goals because I've been obsessed, especially with your latest project. So you've been doing film and television for over 30 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'd say I essentially started in 1985 with my internship when I was in college on a film on incest and child sexual abuse.
Wow.
Which is, yeah, pretty dark, but in totally inspiring, amazing film. And that's what really inspired me to get into film was like, wow, you can make such a difference in the world and really change lives and help people in a way that you can't one by one.
Is that what makes you more interested in documentaries? Is because they kind of shed a different view?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of amazing feature films and fictional pieces out there that do the same. But I guess I'm just more drawn to the real stories and to real life transformation, because what drives my work is transformation, is seeing how do people transform, what methods they use. And we all do it differently. And it's all about finding what works for us individually, because my practice may not work for you and vice versa. And it doesn't make either one right or wrong. It's just a journey of finding out how do I, you know, transcend and transform trauma in my life. And so that's what really propels me. And that's the through line.
2014 is when you did your first documentary yourself. So before that, what would make you interested in a project? Was it because it had something to say?
Yeah. I mean, I lived in LA and I worked in the film industry there, and I worked as a camera assistant and camera operator was sort of my bread and butter. And then I generally worked on about one documentary a year, and they were really about, there was a variety of things, but generally speaking, they were kind of social issue. One was a comedy camp for disadvantaged kids, the children's peace movement in Colombia, who were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. So things like that. And then when I left LA, it was really like, okay, it's time for me to do my own work. And I did do a couple of small projects, I did a short documentary about the differences in it between typical kids and kids with disabilities in terms of friendships and the advantages to typical kids of befriending a child with special needs. So I did some smaller projects, but Walking the Camino was my first big documentary.
Right. I also was listening to a podcast that you did, and I can't remember who it was with, but with your 10 best spiritual books, or this books about spirituality. Because I've read like maybe five of the books that you mentioned. And when did that journey start for you? When did you start really getting into it on that level? Because it's definitely to me, it's a different level. Because for me, it started during the pandemic. So,
I'd say for me, it really started when I had been living in Spain and living with a man there. And we broke up and I was like, where am I going? What am I doing? And I moved back to California, and my dad gave me Louise Hay's Heal Your Life book. And that was really the beginning of my journey. And that's when I really started going to workshops. And my dad was also really into a guy named Lazarus, which is also about a lot about the law of attraction and lots of different workshops. And so that's where it really started. And then it really kicked into high gear when I started going to Agape in LA with Reverend Michael Beckwith and started taking classes, became a spiritual practitioner there. And at that same time, I also started going to Al-Anon. So it was like kind of all these different things happening that were really pushing me forward.
And I think I read that you were 27 when your dad gave you that book. Which is,
yeah,
it's an interesting year, right? Because a lot of people have weird transitions at 27. It's my favorite. It's my favorite number. But how amazing to have such I wouldn't say cool dad, but a dad who is progressive like that.
Yeah, that's the paradox of like the podcast as well as like my father that showed me this. I mean, the paradox with the podcast, which is it's about this man that committed murder at 16. And then does this incredible transformation and becomes this amazing man. My father, on a spiritual level, was amazing. But emotionally, he was like a six-year-old. And so he was great in so many ways and so challenging in others. And learning to kind of appreciate all the great stuff he brought to my life. And just go, yeah, he was a really damaged little child that needed a lot of help and was not the best dad in so many ways. So he was both.
Right. Well, you know, I feel like kids are closer to the source than adults. And I also think as we get older, we get closer to the source too. So on those two ends of our life spectrum, I feel like sometimes we can see things. We're not as tainted by the world that we live in sometimes.
Yeah. It feels like dementia is this time where you're actually kind of can be processing a lot of the stuff that went on for you in your life. This woman I met, Lauren Kessler, is an author, and she wrote a bunch of books about the folks that are in my podcast. But she wrote a book called, I think it's called Dancing with Rose. Her mother had Alzheimer's, and she really didn't take care of her the way she wished she had. So she went back and worked in an Alzheimer's home for like 4 months. And she was talking about like seeing how people with dementia, like where they went. And it makes so much sense that there really is. I mean, there's so much order in what we seem to be chaos. Why wouldn't there be order there too? Why wouldn't there be a great thing happening when people are experiencing dementia?
Yeah.
And I always think of it too as like people have like one step on the other side, and like the people that they're talking to or like what we think is nonsense, maybe those are people on the other side that they're having conversations with, or, you know, that just happened and they're kind of in that reality and ours at the same time.
Having you say that makes me think of something I heard you say in an interview too about walking the Camino. There was a thin veil between this life and the next life, because you lost a brother when you were young, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the first time I walked the Camino, it blew me away. I mean, my brother died when I was 10, and, you know, I was 40-something when I walked the Camino the first time, and it was as if it had happened last year. I mean, there was like a lot of grief that came up, and then there was just this feeling of him being there. And I've talked to a lot of people that have had that same experience, that there's just something magical there.
What brought you to walk the Camino for the first time? Had you heard about it? Had you read about it? What was it in your life that drew you there?
So I had lived in Spain. I went on a school year abroad program when I was in high school. I lived there my junior year, and then I ended up living there for 6 years, living primarily with a family and then with a boyfriend. And so I'd always known about the Camino. It was always in the back of my head because everybody in Spain knows about it. And at this point, this was 2008, barely anybody in the States had known about it. And I just remember I was a guy I'd been living with. He and I had broken up. I wasn't sure where I was going, what I was doing. And it was just this big transition time, but you know, between jobs, relationships, and living situations. And literally the idea just kind of popped into my head, you should go do the Camino. And so then I started doing a little research and talking to some folks, and I did a work study program at Esalen, this wonderful place.
I've been there, yeah.
I'm sure you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was a woman there that had walked the Camino. And so I just peppered her with questions endlessly. And then a couple of months later, off I went. And I just was doing the Camino. I had no intentions of making a film about it. I mean, I was just doing it for myself and healing for leaving this relationship. And then as I walked, there's one man in particular was like, oh, you should do a documentary on the Camino. I was like, uh-uh. I had independently produced and directed a short film, the one about kids with special needs. And I was like, I vowed I would never, ever do it again. So I was like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. And then I got back to Portland where I was living temporarily, but I got a place. And I did a slideshow for all my friends and this big involved thing. And then that little voice just did not stop. It was like, you need to do a documentary. You need to do a film on the Camino. And it just kind of kept at me. And I was like, okay, fine. I'll do it. And it was hard. It was really hard.
How many years did it take to do it?
Seven.
Wow.
Well, I filmed in 2009, and then, oh, I guess it was 5 years, 5 years. And then there was the other 2 years of distribution. The hardest part was raising the money, because I had raised just enough, because I had raised some money for another film. And my old boss from Breaking Silence, the woman who kind of inspired me to get into filmmaking, she and I partnered together. So we had just enough to do the production, to do the filming. And then, you know, we had 300 hours of footage and not a penny left. So that was the big journey, was raising the money. And after like a year, my partner, she was like, you know, I've exhausted everything I can think of. I need to move on. I'm out. And I understood it. I mean, it was my dream. It was my vision. But then I was just like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Because we applied to, I don't know, dozens of foundations, and they all turned us down. And so then I finally turned to asking pretty much everyone I had ever met for money.
Mm-hmm.
And doing a crowdsourcing campaign. And this was in the very beginning days of, you know, Indiegogo and all the crowdfunding things. And we managed to do it, but it took a long time.
You mentioned that little voice that kept talking to you. Do you think we all have that little voice? And is that intuition? And why do we not listen to it? have you had it before this point, but at some point you know?
Yeah, I think we all have it. And this was actually like one of my first spiritual teachers, Lazarus, was like, listen to the whispers, because otherwise they turn into 2x4s.
Yeah.
You know, you can get the like quiet whisper, or you get like this big blow, like you need to do this.
Right.
I think my spiritual path was very much a part of that, of learning to listen to that voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that was a big thing, was how do I know when it's the really innate wisdom, and how do I know when it's my ego? And I remember meditating once, and I'm a big dog fan. I've always had dogs. And I believe like I have a higher self that is kind of in charge of everything. And is very much connected with the divine. And I'm just like, kind of like, how do I know when it's you and when is it my ego? And the writing or the answer I got, he's like, it's really simple. It's just like Leon, my dog. You call, I come, I love you.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh.
Yeah. I also read somewhere too that, you know, that inner voice, if it's coming from the right place, it feels good. And when you go against it, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel good. So I've been trying to listen and learn, you know, but it's a process for sure.
Oh, it's like constantly a process. But I do think being in nature, meditating, you know, all those things really help align us. And being with animals, I think, too.
Yes. I had like two kittens laying here by my feet right now. So,
yeah. My dog, my office is too cold for my dog.
There's about, I read, is it accurate, 250,000 people walk the Camino a year?
You know, I haven't looked at the stats recently, but it very well could be more. It's just exploded in popularity.
It seems strange that people would subject themselves to walking 500 miles for what, right? So, but I think I heard you say that everyone walks it for a different reason. There's so many different reasons, so many different journeys that people are on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It really struck me because when the film came out, there was a publicist that was helping me and was booking stuff. And she was also booking for this guy that had written a book on the Camino. And we were on a joint interview. And the person said, you know, what is the Camino about? And Kurt said, it's all about learning to say goodbye. And then they asked me, and I was like, I think it's different for everyone. Like, that was what it was for him, but it's so different. And that's what makes the Camino. And I think the ranch to me is like, is so much like the Camino. You never know exactly who you're going to meet, what's going to happen. I mean, there's a lot more unknown on at least on the ranch, you know where you're going to sleep and you know it's going to be comfortable.
Yeah, that's true.
But you still don't know who you're going to meet, what kind of interactions you're going to have, what you're going to learn that day. And there's something like so thrilling about that, of not knowing on the Camino, like not knowing exactly where you're going to sleep. Or even if you do know, you may not know what it's like or who's going to be there. And there's so much that then is open for the divine to kind of show up and give you what you need. And the magic of the Camino is it feels like it contorts to give what each person needs. There's somebody that, a woman that started a website and a group called The Camino Provides. And that's kind of a little saying, is it provides, like, when you're, you know, cold and hungry, then all of a sudden, you know, somebody shows up and they're like, hey, I have a half a sandwich. You want it? That kind of thing.
It's interesting because the correlation between the ranch, too, because I know so many of the guests and I host something for guests that have been here 20 times or more. And it's interesting when you talk to them, like every time they come, they're going through something different, but they seem to find what they're looking for. And I think you have to be in the right space, too. And I think nature helps put you in that space. Is there like one or two things that you personally got from the Camino that you'd be willing to share?
I think that one of the main things I got was really a much broader acceptance of we all do it our own way. You know, I think I had been a little bit like, this is the right way, or I can get kind of attached to, you know, thinking this is the right way to do things. And it just permeates everything, that it's really so individualistic. It's so visceral on the Camino because, you know, everybody has different gaits, how fast they walk, how comfortable are they best walking 20 kilometers or 40. And you see people that get in trouble trying to do things out of their realm. Like if people are trying to walk too fast, they're trying to keep up with someone, they end up getting like horrible shin splints or tendonitis. You know, so it's such an immediate, like, you need to follow your path.
Right. My personal belief is that there's an ultimate truth in the universe or in the world, and that we're all trying to find it. But there's lots of different ways to get to it, but it's still the ultimate truth. There's still that one truth.
Exactly.
Hi, My name's Mimi Hancock. I'm from San Francisco. I've been to Rancho La Puerta for now my 24th time. It's my happy place. I came the first time with my mother as a college freshman in 1971 and have always enjoyed coming here ever since. For me, it's heaven on earth. The place, the people, the spirit of the place. My mother found Rancho La Puerta, I think, sometime in the 60s, and it was also her happy place. She felt very free here, carefree, and of course introduced her children and friends to Rancho La Puerta as well. Then it came clear that my father's mother came here in the 1940s. I discovered this through correspondence that she wrote from Rancho La Puerta. She would stay here for a month at a time. So that was in the 1940s. So I guess you could say I'm third generation lover of Rancho La Puerta.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. Do you have any advice you'd give someone who's considering doing the Camino?
I mean, I would highly encourage people to do it on their own, to not do a tour, to not book ahead, not do a guided. And there are great tour groups out there. I mean, there's a group called Spanish Steps and this wonderful woman that she's been doing it forever. But if you know exactly where you're going to be sleeping, you're kind of not open to the synchronicities of the Camino. And most importantly, I feel like it's so great to be able to listen to yourself and say, oh, this town feels great. I want to stay here. Oh, no, actually, I really want to go. I want to walk another 5 kilometers today. Or to be able to start developing, listening to that intuition and listening to that still small voice inside. And I think if you're in a like guided group or even self-guided, you're locked into a lot of things. And so you can't listen to that voice as much. That said, it's really easy to like call and book ahead. And if you want to like make sure you have a place, but I'd say that's my biggest. And the thing too is I know some people as they get older, I mean, it's harder for me to carry a pack now than it was, you know, 10 years ago. You can send your pack ahead, you know, if you have a health issue or, you know, you're not going to do it otherwise. So there's ways to work around it. And I also really encourage people, it's a phenomenal thing to do alone. You don't need to wait to have somebody to go with. I mean, I encourage people to do it by themselves.
Okay, now we're going to switch gears.
Okay.
Because you have, I guess it's a series of podcasts now, Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, right?
Yep.
It's my understanding that it was going to be a documentary and then the pandemic happened and it turned into a podcast series. And how many episodes are there? Is it 9?
Well, it's 8. Well, 8 official, and then we have several bonus episodes, but 8 official episodes.
Just so you know, like last week, I listened to everyone obsessively. I listened to it all, and I would recommend that everyone listens to it. It's such a message that I don't think we hear. You know, I was thinking about it when I was listening to it. It's kind of like, you know, when you go to the grocery store and like you buy some meat, you're like, you don't think where that meat is coming from, what happened to those animals or what happens. But I think that our criminal justice system too, I think you heard said you hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about it. And I think most of us don't think about it. And we try not to think about things that are uncomfortable. Right?
Totally.
Yeah. How did this come to be?
I have one of my dear friends, Phil Stockton, and he used to live here in Portland. We were friends in high school. Actually, it was my boyfriend in high school. And we just stayed friends throughout the years and then reconnected in Portland when I moved here. And on the side, his volunteer gig was he was teaching theater at Oregon State Penitentiary. And I remember going, wow, you drive an hour there, an hour back on a weeknight when you're working full time and you teach theater. I was kind of like, wow, that's good for you. I mean, not sure I would do it. And then And then he had a play that they had put together on solitary confinement, which was The Bucket, which we feature a little bit in the podcast and on the videos. And so he invited me down. And once for Soldiers of Peace, I had gone into like a kind of juvenile delinquent center. And so I was like, I've been to prison, no big deal. And then when you go in, they literally read you the riot act. Like, you know, if something happens, you're on your own. So all of a sudden, my whole attitude was like, oh boy. Okay. And I was the only woman. It's a men's prison. And Phil and I, and like, there's three other people from the outside coming in to see this play that he had directed about solitary confinement. We go up and we're accompanied by an officer, and then the officer disappears. There's all these prisoners walking around. And my mind went immediately into who's going to hurt me, who's going to help me, like survival mode, like what's going to happen when there's a riot or if there's a riot. And so Phil had to go do something. So I'm the only woman, and there's like 50 guys, incarcerated men, and then a couple of guys from the outside, no officers. Phil's gone. And he's like, oh, why don't you talk to Terrence? And so I start talking to Terrence, and I'm like, okay, he'll hide me in a broom closet if anything happens, but he's not going to lay his life down for me, but he'll kind of help me. But my mind was just going. So anyway, the play happens. The play was mind-blowing. It was a sort of ensemble play about solitary confinement, and some of the performances were just amazing. And afterwards, we started talking, and then we were talking to some of the performers, and I started talking to Sterling, who was kind of the main character in the play, and my body just relaxed. And I was like, oh, if anything happens, he will protect me with his life. And I just knew that. I knew it. And he's the leader of this whole group. And so then as we were leaving, one of the guys that came in with us, who was a friend of Phil's, he was like, yeah, I really want to do a documentary about the theater program, but really I really want to do a documentary about Sterling. I was like, oh, I get it. You know, he just has this magnetism and charisma. And so ironic, like, I never feel safer than when I'm with Sterling. A man who had committed murder makes me feel safer than anybody else because I know he has crazy conflict resolution skills. But anyway, so then I signed on to, said to Ryan, I was like, if you want help, I'm happy to help. And so we partnered and we spent the next 2.5 years trying to get permission to film inside the prison. And then he had a big life change and he and his family moved to Mexico. And then I finally got permission to film. And that was in January of 2020. We were going to shoot once a week for about 6 to 9 months inside the prison. So obviously that didn't happen. So that was the long version of how I came to do it.
So what happened then is that it was interviews then, since you couldn't do the filming?
Yeah, I followed the story and I interviewed people, you know, over the phone and people on the outside. And I kept following what was happening to Sterling. And really, I mean, it was just so kind of divinely led and inspired in terms of the podcast was really so much of a better medium. Because Sterling's story is so involved, and to try and capture all of it really would have been challenging in just a 90-minute documentary. So I'm really pleased. And then we have the videos, which barely any podcasts have, like, real videos. I mean, because we had filmed 50 hours of footage. So I was like, we got to use this. And so I feel like they kind of fill in some of the gaps or expand. You hear about a specific story, but then you get to see it and you get to see Sterling talk, or you see pictures and you can see how he transforms. And one of the mini documentaries is called Turning Points. And we have all these different pictures of him throughout the years. And you can see how his face softens and how his whole energy shifts as he transforms himself.
Were there specific messages you were hoping that people would become aware of certain things based on the podcast?
You know, I start all of my projects. I did this with the Camino and I did this with this. I start at the very beginning kind of trying to imagine, how do I want people to feel after they've listened or watched? And so it's really a feeling tone, like, how do I want them to feel? And I spent a lot of time, I did visioning for both my projects. Like, I had no experience with jails or people in jails. And then realizing, wow, we really do need to take care of this. Like, this is something that so many of us just are like, I'd rather not look. I don't care. I'm just going to live my life. But it's a huge drain on the taxpayers for a system that is completely inefficient. You know, our recidivism rates are just horrendous. And so communities aren't safer. People aren't getting reformed. And then victims aren't healing. So it's not serving any purpose. So I really wanted, like, lay people that aren't involved in the criminal justice system to start opening their hearts and their minds to, wow, this is an issue that needs to change, you know, and I need to pay better attention to who is the DA in my district, and what are their commitments to reformation and transformation inside prison, and maybe diverting people from prison to programs. And then also, my vision really was for it to be healing for victims, which I know was a really big stretch. And I was just thrilled, like a month ago or something, we got a review on Apple Podcasts from somebody who had lost a family member to a serial killer. And they said, you know, your podcast has completely shifted things for me. I never really believed people could change. And this particular, the guy that killed my family member hasn't, but I can see that these people can and want to. And it's such an inspiration for me to listen to this. So that was really meaningful to me. And then the other part is for people that are incarcerated or who have caused great harm in their lives to realize there is hope and light. You don't have to completely fall in the shame pit and live in the shame pit, beating yourself up. I'm a horrible person. I did this awful thing. I don't deserve to live. Like, there really is hope. Like, you really can change yourself.
Yeah.
So it's multi-layered. And the biggest of them all was the hope that we could change the criminal justice system, that we could really start working towards restorative justice, a system that addresses the needs of the victims as well as the offenders and the outside community. Because right now, after somebody commits a crime, victim services end. And so here you are left, you know, like, my sister was just murdered, you know, okay, the guy's in jail, but the only currency the system gives us now for victims is long sentences. Like, there's no structured interaction, or what they really want is, you know, an apology, an assurance they'll never do it again, that they're going to change. And right now, people can go in prison and just do their time and not work on themselves at all.
Right. A couple of things that I know I got from the story, like, takeaways for me is, first of all, like, you know, I wish our gun laws were different in our country, because we have kids with guns. And at 15, 16, your brain is not formed. And I can think of things that I did as a teenager that I wish I hadn't done. But thank God nothing changed the whole course of my life from what I did. And I think we all could kind of relate to that. Something else that I got from the podcast is that 50% of kids in foster care end up incarcerated. There's a real problem. And like, Sterling's story is not that uncommon for, and especially for kids of color. It's like, it's pretty horrific, you know, but it's, then you have the other side, right? You have the victim side too. So it's such a complicated issue. But I thought it was done so well. Like, I literally listened to it every night until I finished listening to it. So it made me feel really inspired to, which I think that documentaries like done can really inspire people to change or have an awareness and start caring and opening a part of their heart to something that they hadn't before.
Thank you so much, Barry. That means a lot, especially coming from you, you know, someone that's kind of been in the transformation world, and you've been at the ranch so long and seen so much. And I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate what you're saying about the gun laws, because would Sterling have, like, you know, as a kid, would he have stabbed someone? Or I don't think so.
No.
But when you take a gun And you literally, all you need to do is like, you know, move your index finger. That's all you have to do to kill someone. You know, no wonder there's so many people and accidents. And yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, it's crazy. So when you'll be at the ranch December the 14th this year, looking forward to that. And what will you be talking about at the ranch this time?
I will be showing Walking the Camino, and then I'll do a Camino 101 talk. I have a slideshow and I kind of talk about all the nitty gritty of doing the Camino and advice and my experience. I've done, depending on how you count it, 9 to 11 Caminos. And so I talk about things I've learned. And then I do shooting with your smartphone, creating video postcards, because we all are walking around with these phenomenal tools. Right. And most of us don't know how to use even a portion of it. I mean, there's tons I don't know. But with the video cameras, I mean, there's a lot of just really basic information and little tips that I tell people. Right. And it's also so much more fun. Like, instead of just shooting someone a text, like, thanks for the flowers, wouldn't it be so much more fun to, like, you know, get a video and you, like, show yourself and, like, oh, my God, look at these flowers. They're so beautiful. Thank you so much. Takes 2 seconds, same amount of time.
Yeah.
And then the last workshop is about Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, where I'll show some of the videos and talk about the podcast.
I'm going to go back and make sure that our website has links to those things so that people can, in advance, see what you'll be talking about, because I think it'll make for a really good conversation. And I'm so looking forward to seeing you in December. I will be here.
Me too. Yeah, we can have lunch or dinner someday.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm going to read a couple of the books that you listed as your favorite spiritual books that I hadn't,
oh, cool,
that I hadn't read. But the Alchemist is probably my all-time favorite. And it's so, yeah. And
I know.
And Louise Hay was one of the first people I got exposed to, too. So it's, you know, it's...
Oh.
Yeah, some pretty amazing stuff. So...
Well... I had an amazing, through Jessica, who teaches at the ranch, we were on a hike and she was telling me about this amazing healer she goes to. And anyway, I was like, if anybody raves that much, I should check her out. So then I checked her out, started working with her. And then partway in, she was Louise Hay's healer.
Oh,
so
my word.
Louise was referred to her. And then she was like, I want to see you twice a week. And then they became best friends. And
there's no accidents.
I know. And Louise, I mean, she's been a life changer for so many of us.
Oh my
gosh,
yes.
I
mean,
yeah.
Even to just end with, like, when she has you get up in the morning, look at yourself in the mirror and say, I love you 3 times. Why is that so hard? And it's amazing. it's a game changer. It really is. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Her legacy lives on.
For sure. Well, Lydia, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed this, and it just makes me excited to have your workshops when you're here. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Well, doing today's podcast, I thought of a story told by Wayne Dyer, one of my teachers who's no longer on this planet, but I'm still inspired by him. This is a story he told about a woman named Portia Nelson, who was asked to write about the story of her life in 5 short chapters. It goes something like this. I'm going to paraphrase to make it quicker. Chapter 1, I'm walking down a street. There's a big hole in the street. I don't see it. I fall in. I'm scared. I'm frustrated. It's not my fault. It takes me a long time, but I find my way out. Chapter 2, I'm walking down that same street. There's a big hole in the street. I see it, but I still fall into it. I'm frustrated. It's not my fault, but I find my way out. Chapter 3, I'm walking down that same street. I see the hole and I still end up in that hole. It's become a habit, but I see where I've misstepped and I get out quickly. Chapter 4, I'm walking down that same street. There's a hole in the street. I see it and this time I walk around it. Chapter 5, I walk down a different street. I don't know about you, but I've fallen into many holes going down the same streets in my life, but I feel like I'm starting to find some new streets and avoiding all the holes along the way. I hope that you can have the awareness to find some new streets and notice where the holes are in the streets in your life. For Lydia, walking the Camino was a new street for her and gave her the courage to listen to her intuition that little voice and start doing documentaries that fed her soul and her purpose. Until next time, this is Barry wishing you health and daily joy.